U.S. and EU imposed new sanctions on Russia, covering the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline amid heightened tensions with Moscow over Ukraine. Canada ends emergency powers in vote to tackle truckers' anti-vax protests after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the situation is no longer an emergency. And a Syrian military says the country's air defenses thwart a new Israeli attack over the capital, Damascus. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the U.S. and European Union have imposed new sanctions on Russia amid tensions with Moscow over Ukraine. The U.S. Treasury announced sanctions on a company in charge of building Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Berlin has already suspended its certification of the pipeline, which is to funnel Russian natural gas to Germany under the Baltic Sea. The European Union also targeted Russia's defense minister and military chiefs. 27-nation bloc slapped asset freezes and visa bans on high-ranking officials, including the commanders of Russia's army, navy, and air force, the Kremlin's chief of staff and head of RT TV channel. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin says Moscow is open to diplomacy to resolve the standoff over Ukraine.
Our country is always open for direct and honest dialogue, for the search for diplomatic solutions to the most complex problems. The interests of Russia, the security of our citizens are non-negotiable for us.
In a video address on the occasion of a public holiday, Putin said that Russia's military will stand up for the country's national interests. Moscow has recognized the two self-proclaimed republics of Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine and ratified friendship treaties with them. It also plans to deploy Russian peacekeepers to the breakaway regions. Western states, including the U.S., continue claiming that Russia is preparing a full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree recognizing breakaway Luhansk and Donetsk regions in eastern Ukraine as independent republics. Putin made the announcement live on television after an emotional address. He referred to eastern Ukraine as ancient Russian lands and said it was managed by foreign powers. Putin also told Russia's defense ministry to deploy troops into the two regions. The decree was issued shortly after he announced his recognition of the region's independence from Ukraine. Putin also accused Ukraine of extreme nationalism and Russophobia. He said Kyiv was sending saboteurs to target Russian infrastructure. He denounced Ukraine's ambition to join NATO as an immediate threat of attack against his country. Putin said that the decision was in response to years of conflict in war-torn eastern Ukraine and accused Kyiv of not being interested in peaceful solutions. Russia's top diplomat Sergei Lavrov has said Moscow will act as a guarantor of the security and integrity of the two breakaway Donbas republics in Donetsk and Luhansk. The latest crisis can be traced back to 2014. Back then, Western-backed protesters toppled Ukraine's pro-Moscow government. Tensions then flared up in eastern Ukraine. Following a brief war, Crimea came under the control of Moscow when the peninsula was reabsorbed into Russia following a referendum. Ukraine, as well as most of the world, considered the referendum illegitimate and views Crimea as illegally occupied by Moscow.
The U.S. and Europe are coordinating a raft of sanctions against Russia over its decision on the eastern Ukrainian regions. They have targeted Russia's exports, banking, and financial institutions, as well as individuals. And those measures will certainly have an impact on Russia, but Americans and Europeans, too, will bear the brunt of those sanctions.
Putin's decision to recognize the independence of Luhansk and Donetsk has sparked criticism. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced that Britain is imposing a series of sanctions under the governments against Russia. Five Russian banks, as well as three very high net worth individuals, have had their UK assets frozen. Dutch Prime Minister said European Union countries have agreed to impose a limited set of sanctions targeting those who are responsible for Russia's recognition of the breakaway regions. Germany has also decided to freeze the certification of Nord Stream 2 pipeline project, which is considered a blow to Russia's energy sector. U.S. President Joe Biden has said that the United States would impose financial penalties on Russia because of its deployment of troops into two breakaway regions of eastern Ukraine.
Well, the U.S. has already introduced sanctions. President Biden did that last night. I don't think sanctions by Ukraine against Russia are going to have much of an effect, but the U.S. sanctions and whatever they can pull together with the European so-called allies will have an effect. But the problem is that there's a very shaky international financial system that we have today. It is a bubble economy, and the slightest shock can pull the whole thing down.
Biden said that the U.S. would sanction Russian sovereign debt and Russian elites as well as their family members. New economic sanctions will be placed on Russia's biggest financial institutions as well. The president said he's also working with Germany to prevent the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from moving forward and is cutting off Russia's government from Western financing.
So that what the West is risking here, regardless really of what the Russians do in retaliation, and I'm sure they will react in whatever way they think possible, this whole system can come down in the world's greatest depression. So you have that, the shaky financial system, which is being shaken even more by this crisis. You have the spread of COVID, and you have the danger of war, in fact, possibility of nuclear war. If this thing goes further, it can be really the end of humanity as we know it.
Japan will likely join U.S.-led sanctions on Russia, including a ban on chip and other key technology exports, should Putin order an invasion of Ukraine. Russia has accused NATO of encroaching on its sphere of influence. It says NATO's addition of 14 new East European members since the end of Cold War is a threat to its security. It says Ukraine must not be allowed to join the military alliance. The U.S. and its allies have ruled out defending Ukraine with military force, but say they would respond to any invasion with sanctions, arms shipments, and reinforcements of NATO countries nearby.
Ukraine's parliament approves a nationwide state of emergency to help forge a response to alleged threats of a possible Russian invasion. Motion was approved by an overwhelming majority of Ukrainian lawmakers. The state of emergency will last 30 days and applies to all parts of the country, except for Donetsk and Luhansk in the east. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky proposed the measure after Washington stepped up warnings about chances of an all-out military offensive from Russia. He says some 200 Russian troops are already stationed along the country's border with Ukraine. This comes as the two breakaway Donbas regions have asked Russia to help them repel what they call aggression from the Ukrainian army. After almost a month of protests by truck drivers against COVID restrictions in the Canadian capital, the government now says the situation is no longer an emergency. Speaking during a press conference, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also said that blockades by protesters have ended and order has been restored. The government invoked Emergencies Act last week to clear weeks-long blockades that paralyzed Ottawa. Some opposition politicians have criticized the move, describing it as unnecessary and an abuse of power. Demonstrations initially were started in late January by Canadian truckers against rules that require unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. Protesters later blocked the busiest land crossing between Canada and the United States. The United States imposes sanctions on a number of entities and individuals, accusing them of providing tens of millions of dollars to Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Action freezes any assets of the designated individuals that are subject to U.S. jurisdiction and bars Americans from doing business with them. Those targeted include a UAE and Sweden-based commodities trader and his company, as well as money exchange houses in Turkey and Yemen. They're accused of shipping fuel and other petroleum products and commodities throughout the Middle East, Africa, and Asia, with proceeds financing the Ansarullah. This comes as the movement, along with the Yemeni army, has been defending the country against Saudi Arabia's years-long aggression. The war, which started in early 2015, has so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians. UN says the country is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, Israel has carried out yet another airstrike on Syria, targeting the capital, Damascus. Syrian military says air defenses have intercepted a barrage of Israeli missiles over the city. According to the military, three Syrian soldiers have been killed as a result of the regime's latest act of aggression. Our Damascus correspondent, Mohammed Ali, has given us more details about this attack.
An official military source said in a statement that there has been a new Israeli attack on Syria and aggression at about 1:10 a.m. Local time over here. Israeli fighter jets carried out an attack, launching a number of missiles targeting Syrian army positions in the vicinity of the Syrian capital, Damascus. Syrian military source said in that statement that the Syrian air defenses were able to shoot down most of the enemy missiles. However, the Israeli attack killed three Syrian army soldiers and also caused material damage. Now, this is the second Israeli attack in less than 24 hours. Yesterday, there was an attack on Al-Quneitra in southern Syria, and this is the fourth Israeli attack just this month. It is very important to note that this attack and the one that happened yesterday come just about 24 hours after Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad actually warned Israel from pressing ahead with such attacks. And al-Maqdad said that Syria has the power and the capability to respond to the repeated Israeli attacks, whether in the framework of international legitimacy or in the framework of self-defense, and that Syria has the right whenever it wishes to respond in all forms, and that Israel should realize this fact.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warns Israel against waging a war on Lebanon, adding that his forces are completely prepared for any attack. In an interview with Al-Manar TV, Nasrallah said the Israeli regime is on the decline and on the path to demise. He said the demise of the Israeli regime is only a matter of time, suggesting the term temporary regime to be used for Israel. Nasrallah said that Hezbollah seeks justice and peace and will defend the Lebanese people and their freedom. Palestinians are mourning the killing of another teenager by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. A huge crowd attended the funeral of 14-year-old Mohammad Shahada, who was fatally shot near the city of Bethlehem. In our news review program, we discussed Israeli brutality and its reactions on social media.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, thousands of Palestinians have attended a funeral procession of a teenager killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem. Palestinians also went on a strike in Bethlehem to mourn for 14-year-old Mohammad al-Shahidi. Schools and universities were closed as well. On Tuesday, the teenager was fatally shot in the town of Al-Qadr by Israeli soldiers who were conducting a raid in the area. The killing provoked angry reactions from resistance movements. Hamas said that the killing is a manifestation of the regime's brutality against innocent people. Also, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry called on international bodies to investigate the crimes being committed by the regime's forces and settlers. To discuss that further, we're joined by our very own Mona Kandel, live from Ramallah, and also Mr. Mazin Kamsiya, a Palestinian scientist and author who's joining us live from Bethlehem. Let's begin with our correspondent, Mona. If you could please give us an update on this situation, the mourning procession that was held today, and of course this very tragic incident.
That's right. Another Palestinian child had been killed by the Israeli forces in cold blood. Yesterday, 14-year-old Mohammed Shahada Salah from the village of Al-Khadr in Bethlehem was killed in cold blood by Israeli forces. A statement by the Israeli military claimed that the Israeli soldiers in that area opened fire against Palestinians. They claimed that they threw stones or Molotov cocktails at the fully armed Israeli soldiers. We have to remind our viewers that we are speaking about fully armed Israeli soldiers. There's the separation wall as well. There are checkpoints as well there in the around the village of Al-Khadr. They opened fire, killing him and not allowing any Palestinian ambulance to reach him or to save his life. His body was taken by the Israeli forces. The Israeli military said they will return the body of Mohammed to his family late yesterday, but they didn't. They returned the body of this Palestinian child today. Let's say thousands of Palestinians took part in the funeral procession of this Palestinian child. A general strike and a protest had been witnessed in the city of Bethlehem in order to mourn the Palestinian child Muhammad. And as we have mentioned, he's not the first child to be assassinated by Israeli forces.
And unfortunately, it's not going to be the last either, Mona. Thank you very much. Let's bring in Mr. Kumsia, a Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. It was reported, this child was not even allowed to receive medical care, immediate medical care, after he was shot. What does that tell us about the way Israel is treating Palestinians?
Well, it tells us that the world is turning a blind eye to Israeli atrocities. Israel is acting with impunity and is getting away literally with murder of children. The status of the geopolitical structure in the world and hegemony of the U.S. On the world affairs, and of course the U.S. under the thumb of the Zionist lobby in Washington, has made sure that the world does not obey international law, that they don't sanction Israel, they don't apply pressure in any meaningful way on this rogue state, this apartheid state, as Amnesty correctly described it, this apartheid regime that's really going out of its way to kill and attack Palestinians, whether in Gaza or here in Bethlehem, where I'm speaking to you, next to Al-Khadr. Of course, Al-Khadr is a small village part of Bethlehem area that's been relentlessly attacked over the past few years, including by settlement encroachment, confiscation of lands, demolition of homes. Basically, Israel is acting with impunity.
Thank you very much to our correspondent Mona Kandel, live from Ramallah, and Mr. Mazin Kumsia, Palestinian scientist and author, live from Bethlehem. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of the News Review.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. COVID laws and free mass testing are to be swept away across England after the Chancellor Rishi Sunak won a cabinet battle on cutting the cost of the pandemic, prompting fears that the poor and the vulnerable will pay the price. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalists Rowena Mason, Jessica Elgott and Ian Sample. The piece is titled COVID Restrictions and Free Mass Testing to End in England on 1st of April. COVID laws and free mass testing are to be swept away across England after a Chancellor Rishi Sunak won a cabinet battle on cutting the cost of the pandemic, prompting fears that the poor and the vulnerable will pay the price. Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced plans to end free testing for the general public from 1st of April, saying it was time for people to get our confidence back. People who test positive for COVID will no longer have to isolate by law from this Thursday, and from April will not even be advised to stay at home if infected, the Prime Minister said. The Chief Medical Officer, Chris Whitty, and the Chief Scientific Advisor to the government, Patrick Vallance, struck a more cautious note, however, urging people to keep taking precautions such as isolating and wearing face masks while infections remain high. Speaking alongside Boris Johnson at a Downing Street press conference, they emphasised the need to keep monitoring for new variants, with Chris Whitty warning that COVID could still cause significant problems and cautioning that it is not a trivial illness. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, unveiled the changes after Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, won his fight to slash the cost of COVID testing, which has topped £15 billion in the past year, by up to 90%. Sajid Javid, the Health Secretary, had pushed for £5 billion to £6 billion to fund more community testing and surveillance studies, but failed. After last-minute wrangles that delayed the cabinet meeting by more than 2 hours, additional funding will now have to be found from his own department's budget. Number 10 Downing Street insisted that efforts to reduce the NHS waiting list backlog would not be affected. Conservative MPs opposed to COVID restrictions were delighted at Boris Johnson's move, but it was greeted with dismay by some medics, scientists, charities and unions. Many raised concerns that the low-paid will not be able to afford tests and may come under pressure from employers to work when ill with COVID. Those on low pay will no longer get financial support to isolate if they test positive, and sick pay will revert to the pre-pandemic rules, with eligibility from day 4 of illness rather than day 1. Charities said the end of free tests was also a blow to clinically vulnerable people and older age groups, warning that they may lose confidence about going out in public, while business groups expressed frustration that they would have to take decisions on testing and isolation policies for their own staff. The government said a small number of at-risk groups and care home staff will continue to get free lateral flow tests, possibly the over 80s. But Number 10 Downing Street admitted the details of who will be eligible and its funding had yet to be worked out. Boris Johnson emphasised personal responsibility for COVID in future rather than the government setting restrictions to control it. He said, pharmaceutical interventions such as antivirals and vaccines would be the primary line of defence from now on. We don't need laws to compel people to be considerate to others. We can rely on that sense of responsibility towards one another, he told the House of Commons. Other changes announced by the Prime Minister included contact tracing will end from Thursday and contacts of people testing positive will no longer have to test or isolate. Schools and other educational settings will no longer be advised to test twice weekly with immediate effect. NHS and social care staff will no longer get asymptomatic testing, but this is expected to continue for patients and care home residents. COVID passports will be scrapped from 1st of April, with venues no longer recommended to use them. They will still be available for international travel. The Office for National Statistics Survey of COVID in the community will be maintained but in a slimmed-down version. The Vivaldi study on care homes and panoramic study on antivirals will continue, The government insisted, although it was not clear how they will be funded and whether enough testing is being done to support them. At Boris Johnson's first press conference since 19th of January, Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance emphasised that the ability to maintain surveillance and ramp up testing again would be crucial in the future. Chris Whitty stressed that people with COVID should still self-isolate, even though the government has not committed to renewing that advice beyond April. Prime Minister Boris Johnson insisted there was no division on the living with COVID strategy. I don't want you to think that there is some division between the gung-ho politicians and the cautious, anxious scientists. We have a very clear view on this, that this has not gone away, he said. Patrick Vallance suggested he was concerned about the rates of infection once people returned to pre-pandemic behaviour. In terms of the current situation, I like the prevalence to be lower. I'd like rates of infection to be lower. We're not back to pre-pandemic behaviours yet. And as those returns, you would expect the pressure and transmission to increase. The changes were met with scepticism from the Labour Party, who accused the Prime Minister of weakening sick pay in a way that will hit the lowest paid and the most insecure workers the hardest. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer said, "We can't turn off Britain's radar before the war is won. Ignorance is bliss, is not a responsible approach to a deadly virus. In actual fact, risks undoing all the hard-won progress the British people have achieved over the last 2 years. Some scientists said it was right to begin winding down the pandemic response now the Omicron peak has passed, but others expressed worries about the consequences of an abrupt end to free testing. Professor Stephen Reicher, a member of SAGE's Behavioural Science subgroup, said he was concerned it exacerbates inequalities for those who can't afford to test or to self-isolate. All the rhetoric about freedom and about choice and about allowing people to exercise personal responsibility hides the fact that those freedoms and choices are limited to those who have the means, he said. Johnson's removal of support for self-isolation and testing takes choice away from those who cannot afford to stay home or buy testing kits. Johnson exposed the fallacy of his argument in asserting that anyone who wants to can buy a test. No, they can't. If they are already having to choose between eating and heating, tests are an impossible luxury. Following the announcement, free government lateral flow tests appeared to have run out, with a message saying there are no home delivery slots for these tests right now.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, I have the honor and pleasure of being joined by my darling sister and special guest, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. How are you, my dear?
I'm very good, thank you. So, I don't know which part of the world you guys are on in... I'm a firm believer of living your life, not caring what others think, and not necessarily...
You're a believer of this?
Yeah. And
you don't give a fig?
No. I really don't. Not waiting for external validation. And I believe that living up to other people's expectations of us is somehow toxic for everyone. But...
So how do you know if you're doing the right thing?
Whether we like it or not, we are social creatures, right? And there's a certain degree of norm that we kind of have to abide to in order to be able to live a harmonious, relatively peaceful life and be able to have healthy relationships in general. And as Muslim women, we're not an exception. I also cannot deny that there's a great amount of double standards, you know, directed toward the Muslim community when it comes to the society's expectations of a Muslim woman and a Muslim man. I don't want to turn this into a battle of genders. It's really sickening how almost every social topic in this world turns into a battle of genders. I'm not in any way a feminist at all.
I can see that.
I'm a justicist. I want justice.
Okay.
Right? We talk about society's expectations of a Muslim lady. And then I want to talk about how fair these expectations are.
How fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
And whether or not they're realistic.
That's a very good expectation.
Whether or not they have the same expectations from them. Well, maybe they don't, because men and women have totally different responsibilities. But do they hold men to these standards, as high as standards as they hold women? Because if they don't, because if they don't, then the society is going to be lopsided, right? And it's going to be dysfunctional, and the women are going to turn dysfunctional, and the men are going to turn dysfunctional, and the world will be chaotic, and it will burn as we see it now today.
Actually, last night I was reading this book, this really nice book that I'm falling in love with. It's called Identity of Iranian Men in the Area of Qajar and One More Era, which is very close to this era. And it talks about how the definition...
It's a Farsi book?
Yeah, it's a Farsi book. Actually, my professors in university introduced us this book. And since I'm in love with gender studies, men's identity, I got this book and I'm reading it very carefully, like line by line, not like novel reading. I'm reading it like analytically. This book actually talks about who was considered as a good man. And he talks about...
Back in those times.
Back in those days. About 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A century ago.
Oh, the world has changed so much
right,
since.
Right, exactly. And it talks about the concept of Javan Mardi or chivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And then it says that, like, how in the passage of two or three decades, this whole definition changes, right? Like, it was actually saying that it doesn't really matter from which walk of life you are, whether you're an aristocrat or whether you are down there.
Right.
Doesn't really matter. There were specific criterias or standards that if any man had that, like protectiveness of the fellow men in his neighborhood, fellow men and women and children in his neighborhood, being caring about them. Mm-hmm. If he saw like someone bothering them, he would come to the rescue. The other one was generosity and kindness. It reminded me the qualities of Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
That even sometimes it was written that they would raid caravans that were coming like from Russia, that were going all the way to the Qajar king, a caravan holding a lot of gold and silver and gems and jewelry, and they would stop them. They would distribute the money and the goods among poor people in the neighborhood.
Fascinating.
Would you believe that?
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Thank you again for joining us. We've been talking about some really interesting stuff.
Sometimes, Zainab, when we're watching cartoons and when we're watching animation movies of... the Disney, right, like the Aladdin or Robin Hood, any of these, they have like a they're coming from real backgrounds. Although they are made dramatic.
Art imitates real life.
Exactly. And I didn't believe that until I read history.
True. Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm just saying that, and so at one stage of time, this is how a good man was described. Later on, when you move into history, because your question was that we have double standards for a Muslim lady. Last night, the pages that I was reading was about how the men, like athletic men, who was considered to be an athletic man physically and ethically. Mm-hmm. And like in the about 120 or 30 years back, mm-hmm. when men used to go to the zurkhanas, mm-hmm. right, where only men came. And there was no place for, even now, the zurkhanas are not a place that women can attend in Iran, right? So ethical qualities were super important as one of the main characters of a champ. As we move on in the era of Qajar and after, where rich people came into the, they bought their own zurkhanas, they built their own zurkhanas. And so physical strength, like in the zurkhana, you stay still and you do your exercises. After 20 or 30 years, you had to move. Motion was something very important, and physical structure became one of the positive standards, one of the very good qualities that that an athlete should have. Mm-hmm. But 20 or 30 years back, it wasn't really important if you had like, if you were, you know,
broad
built
shoulders,
muscles, broad shoulders, yeah. muscles. It wasn't really important. Ethics was very important. Mm. Nowadays, Zaina, when you're looking at sports and when you're looking at athletes, ethics does not play any role. Mm. Very, very skimp, small, trivial role that it's not really important. What's really important is what you wear and how you are, like your height, your muscles, your weight.
And your skills on the field.
Exactly. Mm. So you're right. But we have to see that. And this is something really bad that has been happening. And this is going on in women's sports as well.
There was so much on my mind in my bed I lay. I turned to my side and I heard a voice say, stop all your whining, heart rate's declining. You've got so much more than most. Look how you're sleeping, how much you've eaten. Don't you know that you're supposed to say sabah and shukr are wonderful things. The praises to Allah we should always sing. When things go right, it's from Him, not me. And when they are wrong, we get through patiently. I got out of bed, began to walk. Bumped into some folks and we started to talk. Did you hear about the killing, the bloodshed, the stealing? The grass got burnt on the other side. Soldiers are coming, people are running. All that's left is the orphan child. Sabah and shukr are wonderful things. The praises to Allah we should always sing. When things go right, it's from Him, not me. And when they are wrong, we get through patiently. I opened my eyes and began to see.
When I look at like the top-notch athletes,
Do have some ethical figures.
Yeah, and also like their true sportsmanship is still valued in them. Though this is totally irrelevant to the topic of our discussion. Please carry on.
Yeah, but the thing is that how we get our standards, how do we get our values from?
It definitely has become more superficial.
Exactly, and more physical. Mm-hmm. Like I'm following.
I blame Hollywood for this, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know if we have to blame ourselves and how weak our values are that we quickly just, you know, as the wind blows to one direction, we just follow it. We have to, I think, blame ourselves.
And now that we're aware, it's time to blame ourselves. But when like Hollywood began to take the world by storm and raise certain standards, create actually certain standards and glamorize those standards and those attributes, people didn't know what was going on. Mm. And the masses just drifted toward it, whether men or women.
Because they were so empty of themselves.
And they weren't aware, really, with every piece of technology that comes.
You know where this comes from?
What?
Asian, Eastern, Middle Eastern countries, Muslim countries, were, you know, in the very advent of Islam, we were leading countries.
Yeah.
Right? We had a lot of power, a lot of wealth, politically, socially, economically. And then as the years went by, we shifted away from the direction of Islam, and so many non-Islamic criteria became valuable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
In the field of gender studies and women's studies, what the Prophet was trying to propagate and what the Prophet was trying to spread and teach people in the society, what the society actually believed in and considered as valuable was something totally different.
Oh, wow.
This is actually part of the speech of Lady Fatima.
Yeah, exactly.
Salamullah alayha. That she said, where are you guys going? You know, in the last days of her her life, that when she was in her deathbed and the women came to her and to see her and, you know, to pay her visit, she said, I am so upset with your men. I open every day with this notion, with this thought that you guys took away one right from my husband, without he wouldn't have even used, and he would have used nothing from the Muslim treasury.
Exactly.
He would have consumed the least amount of possible. He wouldn't use your money to build more money. He wouldn't use it for his family. This is what really influential political figures are doing these days, right? They are, after one or two or three terms of being in the government, I mean, they become super rich. Because
and loaded
of their
for
ties,
life, like covered, yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And so, like 2, 3, 4 generations of their family will be filthy rich until the end of their lives. Lady Fatima was exactly touching upon this specific point, that if you go with Ali alayhi salam, your dunya and your akhirah will be safe.
Yeah, our time came to an end, definitely.
And we didn't even. We just
scratched the surface,
yeah,
on this immensely deep and very complex topic. And if you guys want to know where this leads to, make sure to tune in to future episodes of Muslim Lady. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female, and made us into nations and tribes, so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history, just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Artificial intelligence has been identified as one of the top three emerging technologies in conservation, helping protect species around the world. We now present you an article written by Graham Greene. The piece is titled Five Ways Artificial Intelligence is Saving Wildlife, from counting chimps to locating whales. There's a strand of thinking, from sci-fi films to Stephen Hawking, that suggests artificial intelligence could spell doom for humans. But conservationists are increasingly turning to artificial intelligence as an innovative technology solution to tackle the biodiversity crisis and mitigate climate change. A recent report by wildlabs.net found that artificial intelligence was one of the top three emerging technologies in conservation. From camera trap and satellite images to audio recordings, the report notes, artificial intelligence can learn how to identify which photographs out of thousands contain rare species, or pinpoint an animal call out of hours of field recordings, hugely reducing the manual labor required to collect vital conservation data. Artificial intelligence is helping to protect species as diverse as humpback whales, koalas, and snow leopards, supporting the work of scientists, researchers, and rangers in vital tasks, from anti-poaching patrols to monitoring species. With machine learning computer systems that use algorithms and models to learn, understanding, and adapt, artificial intelligence is often able to do the job of hundreds of people, getting faster, cheaper, and more effective results. Here are five artificial intelligence projects contributing to our understanding of biodiversity and species. 1. Stopping poachers. Zambia's Kafue National Park is home to more than 6,600 African savanna elephants and covers 22,400 square kilometers, so stopping poaching is a big logistical challenge. Illegal fishing in Lake Itezitezi on the park's border is also a problem, and poachers masquerade as fishers to enter and exit the park undetected, often under the cover of darkness. The Connected Conservation Initiative, from Game Rangers International, Zambia's Department of National Parks and Wildlife and other partners, is also using artificial intelligence to enhance conventional anti-poaching efforts, creating a 19-kilometer-long virtual fence across Lake Itezitezi. Forward-looking infrared thermal cameras record every boat crossing in and out of the park day and night. Installed in 2019, the cameras were monitored manually by rangers, who could then respond to signs of illegal activity. forward-looking infrared. Artificial intelligence has now been trained to automatically detect boats entering the park, increasing the effectiveness and reducing the need for constant manual surveillance. Waves and flying birds can also trigger alerts, so the artificial intelligence is being taught to eliminate these false readings. Ian Hode, special technical advisor at Game Rangers International, says there have long been insufficient resources to secure protected areas, and having people watch multiple cameras 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, doesn't scale. Artificial intelligence can be a game changer, as it can monitor for illegal boat crossings and alert ranger teams immediately. The technology has enabled a handful of rangers to provide around-the-clock surveillance of a massive illegal entry point across Lake Itsejitezi. Two, tracking water loss. Brazil has lost more than 15% of its surface water in the past 30 years, a crisis that has only come to light with the help of artificial intelligence. The country's rivers, lakes, and wetlands have been facing increasing pressure from a growing population, economic development, deforestation, and the worsening effects of the climate crisis. But no one knew the scale of the problem until last August, when, using machine learning, the MAP Biomass Water Project released its results after processing more than 150,000 images generated by NASA's Landsat 5, 7, and 8 satellites from 1985 to 2020 across the 8.5 million square kilometer of Brazilian territory. Without artificial intelligence, researchers could not have analyzed water changes across the country at the scale and level of detail needed. Artificial intelligence can also distinguish between natural and human-created water bodies. The Negro River, a major tributary of the Amazon River and one of the world's 10 largest rivers by volume, has lost 22% of its surface water. The Brazilian portion of the Pantanal, the world's largest tropical wetland, has lost 74% of its surface water. Such losses are devastating for wildlife. 4,000 species of plants and animals live in the Pantanal, including jaguars, tapirs, and anacondas. People and nature. Cassio Bernardino, World Wildlife Fund, Brazil's MAP Biomass Water Project lead, says, "Artificial intelligence technology provided us with a shockingly clear picture. Without artificial intelligence and machine learning technology, we would never have known how serious the situation was, let alone had the data to convince people. Now we can take steps to tackle the challenges this loss of surface water poses to Brazil's incredible biodiversity and communities." Number three, finding whales. Knowing where whales are is the first step in putting measures such as marine protected areas in place to protect them. Locating humpback whales visually across vast oceans is difficult, but their distinctive singing can travel hundreds of miles underwater. At National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association fisheries in the Pacific Islands, acoustic recorders are used to monitor marine mammal populations at remote and hard-to-access islands. Anne Allen, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association research oceanographer, says, "In 14 years, we've accumulated around 190,000 hours of acoustic recordings. It would take an exorbitant amount of time for an individual to manually identify whale vocalizations." In 2018, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, NOAA, partnered with Google Artificial Intelligence for Social Good's bioacoustics team to create a machine learning model that could recognize humpback whale songs. Number 4. Protecting koalas. Australia's koala populations are in serious decline due to habitat destruction, domestic dog attacks, road accidents and bushfires. Without knowledge of their numbers and whereabouts, saving them is challenging. Grant Hamilton, Associate Professor of Ecology at Queensland University of Technology in Australia, has created a conservation artificial intelligence hub, with federal and Landcare Australia funding to count koalas and other endangered animals. Using drones and infrared imaging, an artificial intelligence algorithm rapidly analyzes infrared footage and determines whether a heat signature is a koala or another animal. Grant Hamilton used the system after Australia's devastating bushfires in 2019 and 2020 to identify surviving koala populations, particularly on Kangaroo Island. Grant Hamilton says, "This is a game-changer project to protect koalas. Powerful artificial intelligence algorithms are able to analyze countless hours of video footage and identify koalas from many other animals in the thick bushland. The system will allow Landcare groups, conservation groups and organisations working on protecting and monitoring species to survey large areas anywhere in Australia and send the data back to us at the Queensland University of Technology to process it." Number 5. Counting species. Saving species on the brink of extinction in the Congo Basin, the world's second largest rainforest, is a huge task. In 2020, data science company Apsilon teamed up with the University of Stirling in Scotland and Gabon's National Parks Agency to develop the Mambaza Artificial Intelligence Image Classification Algorithm for large-scale biodiversity monitoring in Gabon's Lopé and Waka National Parks. Conservationists had been using automated cameras to capture species including African forest elephants, gorillas, chimpanzees and pangolins, which then had to be manually identified. Millions of pictures could take months or years to classify, and in a country that is losing about 150 elephants each month to poachers, time matters. The Mabaza artificial intelligence algorithm was used in 2020 to analyze more than 50,000 images collected from 200 camera traps spread across 7,000 square kilometers of forest. Mabaza artificial intelligence classifies up to 3,000 images an hour and is up to 96% accurate. Conservationists can monitor and track animals and quickly spot anomalies or warning signs, enabling them to act swiftly when needed. The algorithm also works offline on an ordinary laptop, which is helpful in locations with no or poor internet connectivity.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.